Metcast, Tuesday, July 24th, 2018. Hey, MacGeeks, it's time for your Metcast, the show for MacGeeks by MacGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the Maccast. Well, I am fresh back from MacStock 2018, and I have to tell you, I am somewhat reinvigorated and jazzed about just everything we do here in the Apple and Mac community. It's always fun to go to a conference like MacStock and meet with folks and just see how awesome everyone in this community really is. And I have to give a big shout out and a thanks to Mike Potter from For Mac Eyes Only, and also Gary Falk and both their families and everybody who makes that conference happen, because it truly is amazing. If you have ever have an opportunity to attend sometime in the future, you definitely should. So be thinking about it for next year. It is going to be toward the end of July, the last week in July, I think, Mike announced. So I believe that's around, getting my calendar out here, and I should have had it out ahead of time. That's going to be around the 27th and 28th of July. So mark that on your calendar. Get out there for that. I do want to thank every one of you in the MacCast community who was there and came up to me and said hi. I just had so many great conversations at the show, and you know, I'm tired, but super stoked to have done it. And my talk on Markdown went great. Only one tiny little issue, a little bit of nerves in there. But other than that, it went totally great. So it was extremely fun. And again, happy to be back here with you on the MacCast. And we certainly have a number of things to discuss. While I was away, there was a little bit of controversy surrounding the MacBook Pro, and no, it's not the keyboard this time, so we're going to get into that a little bit. Talk about USB fast charging and some more information related to that. Apple's autonomous car project is expanding. Also, your iPhone might be getting a little bit tougher, and then more updates on what's going on with the MacBook keyboard stuff, and a little HomePod thing to talk about, or a few HomePod things to talk about. Then we're going to get into some of your feedback and questions. Got a question about combining video files. We're going to talk a little bit about a feature, an undocumented feature on your HomePod. I have some questions about that, so maybe some of you in the community can help with that. And then torture testing AirPods, what not to do, basically what not to do with your AirPods, and that's going to round out the show for this week. So I say we jump right in, but before we do that, we do need to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is 1Password. You guys know I am a huge fan of 1Password. Actually, the guy from 1Password was at MacStock as well. What a great piece of software. If you need to store your passwords, keep your addresses, credit card information safe, 1Password is that one place where you can store everything. You can store your login accounts. You can fill in your credit card details. You can enter your addresses all with a single click once you have them stored safely in 1Password. You're able to sync all of that data across all of your devices, Mac, PC, iOS, doesn't matter. Then you have instant access to that wherever you may need to go. They've also added some really cool features recently, things like Watchtower, which lets you check and see if your passwords have been compromised. It also lets you quickly analyze and find your vulnerable and weak passwords anywhere your passwords are being reused, and you can actually go through and update those. So it helps you make your passwords more secure across accounts that you already have. And a big feature that I use all the time is a secure password generator. You can even set the parameters, things like length and complexity, whether you want numbers or letters and special symbols. I use that to generate all my passwords for 1Password. And there's just a whole lot more. You can store secure documents in it. I use the secure notes feature all the time just to put bits of information. One thing that I like to do is, you know, those password reset questions that you often get asked. Yeah, you should never put in real information for that. So what I'll do is I will just make things up and I store that information in a note inside the password for that account. So right inside 1Password, you can add additional fields, you can add notes and things like that, stuff that's not a default part of the template, and they make that really easy to use. They've got password history, so if you go in and change your password, you can look back and you can see what the previous password had been. Two-factor authentication support is one of my favorite features. You don't have to use an external thing like Authenticator. If you're using two-factor authentication, that's integrated and built right into 1Password. And of course, they use full end-to-end encryption, the highest level of encryption available, so all of your data is safed. It's kept there locally on your device or on your Mac, that 1Password. Of course, it syncs through the cloud, but once it's doing that, it's all stored encrypted. So on your device, you never really have to worry about that security. And they have great support available one-on-one 24/7. And best of all, because you're a MacCast listener, you can actually get 3 months of 1Password for free by visiting 1Password.com/MacCast. That's 1Password.com/MacCast. And sign up today. If you're not using 1Password already, you really should be. So check it out. And a big thanks to 1Password for their continued support of the MacCast. So more MacBook Pro controversy. This happened while I was out and away. It all started with a YouTuber. Yes, a classic tale these days, right? It always seems like they're discovering stuff. This time around, it was a guy named David Lee. He was doing some testing with the top-of-the-line maxed-out Core i9 2018 MacBook Pro, which should be a screaming machine. He was expecting it to be a vast improvement over the 2017, or at least a significant improvement over the 2017 model using the i7 4-core processor. Of course, the Core 9 is a 6-core processor. And when he was doing his testing, he happened to be using Adobe Premiere, which might not be the best bit of software for testing because it's not fully optimized for Apple's operating system and processors. But regardless, he was testing with that and he was noticing it was not giving the performance he would have expected. And what looked like was happening was that the processors were being throttled when the machine was heating up, when it was, you know, really rocking that processor and things were getting hot. It seemed to be throttling back the speed, and the presumption was that it was doing that to keep the processor cool. And therefore, David Lee's conclusion was that Apple's thin design and cooling solution built into the MacBook Pro was not adequate enough for that high-end Core i9 processor. And you may also be aware that Apple, you know, switched to a processor that's not using the low power DDR4 RAM so that they could actually max out and get that 32 gigabytes of RAM in there that so many people are asking for. So as you might imagine, this ignited a firestorm in the community, all kinds of Reddit posts, all kinds of Mac blogs reporting on this. Some were even calling it Throttlegate because, you know, we always have to have some sort of gate when these controversies happen. Several other media outlets ran similar tests and seemingly confirmed that as temperatures were rising on the new MacBook Pros, there was definitely some throttling happening. As a matter of fact, I think David Lee in his testing also took his MacBook Pro and put it in a freezer and ran the tests and got much better speed improvements. So he was noticing in some cases that the 2017 model was actually outperforming the 2018 model until he stuck it in a freezer and ran the tests. And then he saw about a 30% improvement on some of those tests. Now, again, remember, not fully optimized for the processors, the beta software he was using. It would have been nice if he had done some tests with something like Final Cut 10, but he didn't do that. But regardless, it did seem like there was something going on here. So it wasn't, you know, sort of unproven, but there were a lot of questions left by the testing. And later on, some posters on Reddit did claim that the issue was not necessarily being caused by thermal throttling of the processor itself, but rather they were noticing power throttling with the voltage regulator module, the VRM, on the MacBook Pros. And what was a little bit better about that was that would potentially be something that Apple could fix in software. And what it looked like was that basically Apple had set the internal power limit settings in the voltage regulator module in the VRM incorrectly for the power draw of the new CPU. Basically, they left the settings the same as on the prior generation model, the 2017, which didn't have as much power draw. So basically what was happening was as the CPU would ramp up and try and draw more power, it was being throttled or limited by the voltage regulator module, not because of anything that was going on thermally in the MacBook Pro. But regardless, Apple did reach out after that YouTube video was posted to the original YouTuber and ended up working with him. Their team worked with him to help identify and fix the issue. So while we did have the issue come out, Apple resolved it pretty quickly. They actually sent out a patch this week, macOS High Sierra 11.13.6 supplemental update. And testing by a number of the media outlets that had originally been looking into this seems to confirm that it does fix the issue and things are better. Apple said, quote, "We've identified that there is a missing digital key in the firmware that impacts the thermal management system and could drive the clock speed down under heavy thermal loads on the new MacBook Pro." So they didn't go into specific details on what the problem was other than that statement, but they fixed it. And the bug did affect Core i9, Core i7, and 13-inch 2018 MacBook Pro models. So if you happen to have one of those machines or have one of those machines on order, you're going to want to make sure you get the Mac OS High Sierra 10.13.6 supplemental update to resolve those issues. And Apple did stand behind their performance benchmarks that they had posted on the website. There were some people calling out Apple, saying that they had basically lied about those benchmarks and that it wasn't the case when this whole issue cropped up. They're saying, no, we stand behind those. What we discovered was this bug only happens under the right combination of workloads, at least in our testing. And because we never had that sort of perfect storm of workloads, we never encountered the problem in our testing. We just didn't see it. And they don't believe that most people who purchased or were using the MacBook Pro would have even seen this bug, that it would have, for a lot of people, never manifested itself at all. But still, there's a fix in there now, so, you know, I guess we can move on from this one. There is not a gate, there is not a controversy, simply a bug, and Apple has resolved it. So I always like it when I go out of town and there's a big controversy and then the whole thing is fixed before I even get back, so I can tell you both the problem and the fix. It's always nice when that happens. A few other bits of information and things regarding Apple's updated MacBook Pro models. Apparently, in the 2018 model, there's also a new Thunderbolt 3 controller. The JHL7540 chip is in there. This was something that was discovered by iFixit in their teardown. This is part of the Titan Ridge family from Intel. And what's sort of exciting about this is that chip, the Titan Ridge chip, or this specific model of chip, is listed as being compatible with DisplayPort 1.4. But unfortunately, that doesn't necessarily mean that your 2018 MacBook Pro supports DisplayPort 1.4. It could in theory, but it looks like Apple's done some things in software. Mac Rumors asked Apple about it, and said they said while the new 15-inch MacBook Pro theoretically supports DisplayPort 1.4, it still can't do things like drive an 8K display, something that a DisplayPort 1.4 compatible machine would theoretically be capable of. As a matter of fact, they say both models have exactly the same external display compatibility as the previous generation, the 2017s. That means they can support up to two 5K displays or four 4K displays on the 15-inch model, and up to one 5K display or two 4K displays on the 13-inch model. So you're not going to get anything new out of the gate, but it does have a new chip in there. So potentially Apple might do something with a software update in the future. So I guess we'll have to stay tuned and see if that happens. There's also some new information regarding the 13-inch version of the MacBook Pro, the 2018 MacBook Pro. It has full-speed Thunderbolt 3 ports all the way around. Prior models, if you may remember, the 2016-2017 models had four Thunderbolt 3 ports, but actually only two of them, were full-speed ports, and the other two were reduced speed. The reason for that was, or is, that the processors can handle a certain number of PCIe lanes, and the new 8th generation Intel GPUs or CPUs that are responsible for that, they can provide up to 16 PCIe lanes, whereas the prior generation of the 13-inch could only provide 12, so they had to kind of reduce the transfer rates there. And I think it's the CPU. I have in my notes GPU, so now I don't exactly know. I could be a little bit confused, but I'm going to go with the CPU. It has to do with the Intel CPUs and how it manages that stuff. So that's good news. If you have a new 2018 13-inch MacBook Pro, you don't have to worry about when you're using Thunderbolt devices or Thunderbolt 3 devices, which port you're plugging into now, because they are all running at full speed. And then lastly, again, from those iFixit teardowns, there is a missing data recovery port on the new 2018 models, or probably not really missing, Apple just no longer includes it. And why that is significant is that with the prior generation model, the 2017 model, if you had a problem with your logic board, say your logic board failed, but you needed the data off of the SSD or the flash storage in your MacBook Pro, Apple engineers or the Apple support guys or an Apple authorized service center could actually go in with a special bit of hardware from Apple and plug into this data recovery port and get your data off of, potentially get your data off your Mac. It doesn't look like that port is present in the logic board on the 2018 models, and that's a little bit curious. You would assume that Apple would have some method for being able to extract data off of those SSD drives, even in the 2018 model, but it's not obvious at this point how they might do that, because there is no data recovery port. So I'm not going to go all the way out as some places are reporting and say it's not possible, but it doesn't look like it's as easily possible. And I would say it's just one more reason or for making sure that you're doing your backups. If you don't have backups of your machine, then you run the risk of data loss. And even more so, I guess now, if you're running a 2018 MacBook Pro model. One of the rumors about the 2018 iPhones that we've been talking about that has been getting quite a few people excited is that Apple could include this 18-watt USB-C fast charger in the box. The presumption is that Apple is going to get rid of the USB wall wart that we're used to, replace it with a USB-C version, and include a USB-C to Lightning cable in the box. And what's exciting about that is you'll be able to charge your iPhone up about twice as fast as you could in the past with the 12-watt charger Apple had been including previously. Or actually, I think they still include a 5-watt charger with the iPhone. But regardless, you're going to be able to charge a lot quicker. In fact, this week, they're saying that having that charger in the box might be the only way you can get it, at least at launch. This information comes from Makatakara. They're reporting that the factories that have been contracted to create the charging adapters, the USB-C charging adapters, will barely be able to produce enough to support Apple's needs for the iPhone at launch. So that means that if you want to get a second wall wart running at 18 watts and USB-C, then you're likely going to have to wait a little bit. You're not going to be able to buy that at the same time you buy your updated iPhone. Now, for sure, you'll be able to order one eventually, probably a few weeks after the release of the new iPhones, but something to be prepared for. There also, they say, might be some issues getting a third-party USB-C to Lightning cable. That's because there's a new Lightning chip that would be included, and it won't even be going through the made-for-iPhone certification program, according to rumors, at least until November or December, which would presumably be after, even after the launch of the new iPhones. We typically get new iPhones in September. We're expecting that's when we'll get them this year. So if they're not even looking at the certification program on that chip going forward till November, December, that means you might not be able to get a third-party USB-C to Lightning cable for your new iPhone until sometime into 2018. And even after the chips are, or do receive that MFI certification, there are just four MFI certified manufacturing plants that have been approved to actually produce the part. So that part could be in short supply, making that a little bit more difficult. But these are all things we've encountered with Apple in the past. Eventually, it will get ramped up. And I don't see this as a huge issue. It just means that you're going to have to probably buy Apple's USB-C to Lightning cables again, at least, you know, around or near the launch of the new iPhones. And then just to make matters even more tricky, if you want to get a fast charger that's not an Apple one, you're probably going to have to be waiting for that for a while as well. Makatakara is also claiming that third-party fast chargers may require USB-C authentication in order to be able to charge at full speeds. That means that if a wall charger from a third party, a fast charger, is not certified, it's going to be limited to charging at a very slow 2.5 watts. And the reason for this is that the new USB-C authentication is a way to protect your devices from non-compliant USB-C chargers and also protect them from potentially maliciously embedded hardware or software in USB devices. So they use this authentication to protect, you know, kind of the chain, because we've had issues and exploits through USB-C in the past, and we have also known about issues with non-compliant USB chargers doing things like, you know, causing fires in iPhones and destroying batteries and breaking your devices, and you don't want that to happen. So Apple's implementing this new USB-C authentication standard, but that means that, hey, your devices are going to have to be certified by Apple to be able to be charging at the full maximum speed. And of course, the media is going to imply that this is Apple's way of forcing you to buy their expensive chargers or to extort a high licensing fee from third-party suppliers. But I don't believe that's what's going on here. I think Apple, you know, they're concerned about security and privacy. They're concerned about the quality of the accessories that you're using with your iPhones and iPads. And they want to make sure you're using accessories that aren't going to damage, you know, your very expensive iPhone that you've purchased, right? You don't want to destroy your iPhone just because you bought a really cheap Chinese charger that wasn't certified. And we've always recommended here on the MacCast that you, at the very least, make sure you're buying made for iPhone certified devices. But even there, that can sometimes be tricky. So the idea here is that the USB-C authentication is going to be another layer of protection that we all get. And with that, that's kind of some of the latest information we have regarding USB-C chargers and USB-C fast charging potentially coming to future iPhones. The last time we checked in with Apple's autonomous car project here in California was back in May, and at that time they had 55 self-driving cars on the road with 83 authorized drivers. Well, records recently filed with the California Department of Motor Vehicles now say that Apple is up to 66 cars with 111 registered drivers. So Apple has been heavily testing their autonomous vehicle systems here in California. Now, that doesn't mean that Apple, and as a matter of fact, they don't have a driverless car permit. So the reason they need registered drivers is there actually is someone in the driver's seat. And I think two people actually in the vehicle when Apple is doing their testing of these systems. But they're there to kind of report and sort of take over if there's an issue. And it's at this point not 100% clear what Apple is doing with these testings or what the final end game for this testing is, but we do know that they have been looking at for a while building what Tim Cook has described as autonomous systems. Many of us think that it's likely to develop a sort of platform that they could sell to vehicle manufacturers. We also think that they have a deal in place at this point through rumors and leaks and stuff like that, that they have a deal in place with Volkswagen to create autonomous versions of their T6 transport vans. And this would be a program to autonomously shuttle employees to and from Apple's campus, probably one of the first places we're going to see deployment of this autonomous system that Apple has been working on. But beyond that, we don't really know. If you listen to the Maccast or have been listening to the Maccast for a while, you know my personal theory, and that is that Apple is planning on building a car as a service program. So rather than purchasing a car, I will be able to subscribe to or buy a service from Apple to get autonomous vehicles to come drive me around places. And the advantage of that is once I've tapped into that system, Apple could also potentially sell other services like information services, entertainment services to me for while I'm in that vehicle. So extensions of Apple's music program, you know, Apple Music, and also their new upcoming entertainment program, their TV shows, original TV content, and movies and things like that that they've been working on, that would presumably be something that you could get and use when you're in your autonomous vehicle. So, I think that's most likely how we'll see Apple deploy this stuff, but who knows? It could simply be something they sell to, again, other vehicle manufacturers. But I think there's potentially a lot of applications, both commercial and consumer applications, where they could deploy this technology. And they seem to be quickly moving forward with it and expanding that program, at least based on these latest numbers from the California DMV. Your new iPhone glass is about to get more rugged. Corning this week showed off their latest generation of Gorilla Glass, Gorilla Glass 6. Their claim is that it has, quote, unprecedented protection against multiple drops. They seem to be focused on, dropping devices multiple times, not just that one time you drop it. And also, they say, surviving drops from even greater heights. They claim that the average person drops their smartphone 7 times a year. And so they said, you know, the multiple drops was something they wanted to address. I know in my family, I don't drop my iPhone, knock on wood, all that frequently. I've dropped it a few times, I have to admit, but not that frequently. While as some other members of my family, I think they balance out that equation. They drop it much more frequently, which is why we tend to use rugged cases here in the Maccast household. I prefer Apple's leather case, which I think is great and provides enough protection for me. But, other members of the family, they get the bulkier cases. But, you know, according to Corning, they say Gorilla Glass, it's an entirely new version 6. It's an entirely new composition of glass that's been chemically strengthened to give significantly higher levels of compression than were possible with the Gorilla Glass 5, which is the current generation of Gorilla Glass that you have likely in your Apple device. And at this point, it's possible Apple could already have access to this new glass because they do have a pretty good working relationship, standing relationship with Corning. But we won't know for sure until Apple actually makes the new iPhone announcements. Again, that's expected to happen sometime this fall. But Corning did say in their announcement that they expect Gorilla Glass 6 devices to reach the market in the, quote, next several months. So that does seem like a time frame that could fall within the range of the iPhone 10 announcements, next generation iPhone 10 announcements, that new LCD iPhone. And also, just as further evidence of Apple's relationship with Corning, back in May of last year, Apple did give Corning $200 million from their Advanced Manufacturing Fund to aid them in research and development and also aid them in acquiring new equipment for the production of their Gorilla Glass. So again, I think my gut instinct is that Apple will announce that the new iPhone is using the latest generation of Corning Glass. Although, you know, they haven't specifically mentioned Gorilla Glass in recent announcements. They do talk about the durability a little bit more, but they never kind of call out Gorilla Glass, although, you know, behind the scenes, we know that that's what they are using. And so we'll just have to wait and see. Seems like Apple just cannot escape this MacBook Pro keyboard controversy, especially since the new 2018 models came out and we discovered that there is this membrane on the keycaps. So Apple added this additional silicone membrane in the 2018 model. They're saying it's there to add to the quiet keys, or I guess they didn't really say that, but the presumption is that it's to facilitate the new quieter keys that are on the 2018 MacBook Pro. Apple is just saying that the 2018 is improved with that one new feature. They haven't directly commented on the new membrane, but there was a lot of speculation that that membrane is there to keep dust and crumbs out of the butterfly mechanism, which is specifically the issue that many are citing as having caused problems in the 2017 and 2016 models for a few people. You know, there's a lot of people that have had sticky or non-responsive keys, and cleaning it out can sometimes resolve the issue, but if not, Apple has even implemented an extended warranty and repair program for their keyboard. So something's going on there, and you know, all signs were pointing to this membrane being a fix for that. Well, Mac Rumors this week received internal documents that were distributed to Apple authorized service providers. They got these documents from multiple sources, and the documents indicated that yes, the membrane in the new MacBook Pros is designed to, quote, prevent debris from entering the butterfly mechanism. The language showed up in documentation from the Canadian and European versions of Apple's internal 2018 MacBook Pro service readiness guide. Now, what was interesting is the US version of the same guide did not mention the membrane at all, but it did have a link to a second document, the, quote, Butterfly Mechanism Keycap Replacement MacBook Pro 2018 document. And inside that document, it does mention the keycaps membrane and says its purpose is to prevent debris from entering the butterfly mechanism. So it would seem we kind of have a smoking gun here. A lot of speculation that Apple did not want to publicly admit this membrane was there to deal with the issue, because there are several, actually many, ongoing class action lawsuits regarding the MacBook Pro keyboard, and you know, any information that Apple may have had a kind of would have known that there was a problem with the design would, you know, cause them a lot of issues with that, with those lawsuits. So something they don't want to get out there, but here we are. We have some documentation, so that's probably not going to be very good for Apple. Now, Apple, again, hasn't commented on the new keyboard design other than to say it was redesigned to be quieter. They haven't done that publicly, so this is all rumors coming out and information coming out behind the scenes. And they also say that the stuck or malfunctioning keys on the earlier 2016 and 2017 MacBook Pro models only affect a tiny, tiny fraction of their customers. So they're saying it, you know, it's a really minute issue. It's not a big deal. And the new MacBook Pros aren't redesigned to deal with that issue. But here we have, you know, a lot of evidence to the contrary. And again, they still have a keyboard service program for MacBook and MacBook Pro covering repairs for letters or characters that repeat unexpectedly, letters or characters that do not appear, and keys that feel sticky or do not respond in a consistent manner. And, you know, the nice thing about the program, if you are an owner of the earlier 2016 or 2017 MacBook Pro models, is that if you do have an issue, you're going to be covered under that extended repair program for up to 4 years from the time you purchased your MacBook Pro. So, you know, it's not the best resolution. And many people were hoping that if you went in and got a repair on your 2016 or 2017 model, that you would get the new design with the silicone membrane. Apple has told a couple of outlets, it has been leaked to a couple of outlets from some sources inside Apple that no, they're not going to replace that. You're going to get the same design as you have in the original model in the 2016 or 2017. So a little disappointment for some owners of that model. But again, we asked here on the MacCast how many of you had been impacted by this issue. And it did seem to be a few of you, but not a ton of people. So it seems to back up Apple's claim that the issue only affects a few people. But with this membrane in place, it does look like things should be better on the new MacBook Pro model, but maybe not perfect. iFixit did some additional testing to try and confirm if the new membrane does a good job of protecting those keys from getting stuck or becoming non-functioning, and it does do a great job, but it's not perfect. It blocks most contaminants in their testing, but there's still holes in the membrane to allow the keycap clips to attach to the key, so particles can get through those holes in some rare cases, and then once again, the keys could break or become unreliable. Although it does look like your odds of avoiding the issues with the new models are a lot better, just not 100% guaranteed. So, you know, nothing is perfect in this design, but the 2018 models should be less susceptible to some of the dust and particle issues that the prior generation MacBook Pros were susceptible to. And then finally in the news for this week, it looks like HomePods are going to be getting some new and very welcome features, at least if some information leaked to the French publication, Apple publication iGeneration, is to be believed. They are saying that you're going to get more functionality with the HomePod, with it version 12 of the HomePod software coming out this fall, probably right along iOS 12. The details come from a private beta that has been reportedly seeded to Apple employees, both the internal corporate employees and some retail employees. They say that the new features will include the ability to use your HomePod to make phone calls, a feature that many people, when the HomePod was first released, were a little bit disappointed by. You can't make a phone call directly on the HomePod. Of course, you can make a phone call on your iPhone and then use AirPlay to transfer that over and use your HomePod as like a speakerphone. But with the new update, they're saying you're going to be able to make phone calls. You're going to be able to answer phone calls using your HomePod, even redial numbers, search your call logs, listen to messages in your voicemail, and even make emergency calls. They were less sure on whether or not this would support calling over Wi-Fi or FaceTime audio calls, but I would presume that would be possible as well, that it may even kind of be the default for making phone calls over the HomePod, but they didn't have any information on that in this rumor. They also buried the lead a little bit, I think, because the first thing they talked about was the phone calls, but they're also saying that the new update is going to allow you to set multiple timers on your HomePod, something that many people were baffled by when the HomePod was first released. Currently, the HomePod, you can only set one timer on, and in the case of, a HomePod being in a kitchen environment, you definitely would want to be able to set multiple timers for multiple reasons, right? So that is going to reportedly be coming in the next HomePod update. Another feature they mentioned is the ability to search for songs based on its lyrics. So that could be handy. I often have a hard time, especially when you have a song where there's multiple versions or a song where you might not exactly know the exact title of the song or be able to recall it. It can be hard to pull up on the HomePod. But if maybe you can remember some of the lyrics, it sounds like you're going to be able to ask for that using that, which is kind of a cool feature when you really think about it. A few other features that they are reporting on. The HomePod's going to get the ability to have more information about food and nutrition, also more information on public figures, so you can ask more questions of the HomePod and get more reliable answers around those topics. And they say also the ability to change your Wi-Fi network without needing to reset the HomePod, so you'll be able to access the Wi-Fi networks that your iPhone knows about from the HomePod and switch between them. So if you take your HomePod to a network known by your iPhone, you'll be able to switch over. Whereas currently, if you want to do that, you basically have to reset the HomePod and then go through the connection procedure. So that'll make that a little bit more convenient. And they're reporting that you'll also, with the next software update, be able to use Find My iPhone with your HomePod. You'll be able to ask your HomePod to find your iPhone. And it'll be interesting to hear how that works, considering you don't have a display to show you where your HomePod is on a map. So I don't know if it'll read back the coordinates or the last known location, or maybe where your iPhone is near. I don't know. They didn't go into a description on exactly how that would work, but got my mind thinking, how do you think that would work? But regardless, some great new features coming to the HomePod that we hadn't heard about. So there you have it. With that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I want to take a moment and thank another show sponsor, and that is MasterClass. Now, imagine learning new recipes from Gordon Ramsay, or how about photography tips from Annie Leibovitz? Well, now you can with MasterClass. MasterClass offers online classes taught by some of the most talented and successful professionals in their fields. These are the best in the world. Each class is shot with cinematic production quality and offers on-demand lessons loaded with exclusive content you'll find only on MasterClass. I can tell you, I've been watching MasterClass videos, and the production quality is the best I've ever seen in any online courses, hands down. The content I'm finding not only educational, but really entertaining. They are very well produced and inspiring, and I'm super excited to be using MasterClass. As a matter of fact, my daughter is an aspiring writer, and I'm super excited to share MasterClass courses with her, because there's courses from R.L. Stine of Goosebumps fame on writing for children, and also Judy Blume, and they look amazing. We're going to be diving into those and sharing that. And you can choose lessons from classes taught by over 35 masters, including folks like Malcolm Gladwell on interviewing, Ron Howard on collaboration, astronaut Chris Hadfield on traveling to Mars, and just a whole lot more. They are also adding new courses all the time, and whether you're pursuing your passion or developing your career, you can find a MasterClass for you. And best of all, for a limited time, MacCast listeners can get a free 7-day trial at masterclass.com/MacCast. So learn from the best in the world at masterclass.com/MacCast. That's masterclass.com/MacCast. And a huge thank you to MasterClass for their support of the show. Recently here on the MacCast, we were discussing ripping DVDs and Blu-ray discs onto your Mac. I had shared my workflow specifically for DVDs. I've been using DVD Ripper Pro and iFlix 2 for years. I really enjoy using both of those applications for their simplicity. In case you missed that episode, yeah, you can go back and listen to it. But Ryan wrote in to say that he had tried out both pieces of software, both those pieces of software, and was really enjoying using them, but he ran into a little bit of a, not so much an issue, but a question with media. He has a couple of things that have the media spread across multiple discs. I think in his particular case, he cited Godfather Part 2, which actually is on two DVDs, not just one. And he asked, how do you handle that? You know, how can you combine the two separate rips into a single file? And I have to admit, I had to do this, I believe, with my extended editions of Lord of the Rings, but I honestly don't remember how I accomplished it. I have them there in iTunes. They're a single file, but I don't remember how I merged them together, how I put them together. My memory is a little bit foggy. I'm getting a little bit older, but I seem to remember maybe using MPEG Stream Clip from Square 5, and I went to go look for that software, but it hasn't been updated since 2012, and it looks like it might not be, it may no longer be available. And I know that Apple has moved away from using QuickTime, and it probably relied upon the QuickTime technology, so they've moved on and they're using new frameworks in the latest version of Mac OS for dealing with and handling video. So I'm guessing that's why that's not available anymore. To answer your question, Ryan, or maybe to help you out, I believe you can actually do merging and combining of video using FFmpeg from the command line. I know that's probably not the ideal answer that you're looking for. You're probably looking for something a little bit simpler, something more WYSIWYG, but I will link in the show notes at maccast.com to some instructions over on Stack Overflow that I found for combining two video files using FFmpeg. And what's nice about this is it has some instructions for doing it, whether or not the two separate video files or the multiple separate video files have been encoded using the same parameters. Now, typically, I think you do want to ensure that the files that you're combining are in the same format. So say, you know, both H.264 or both H.265, and that they were encoded using exactly the same specifications. So that shouldn't be a problem if you're using like DVD Ripper Pro and you kind of left the settings all the same. You should have multiple files that are in exactly the same format and that were encoded in exactly the same way, and you should be able to combine those. I have a suspicion too, there may also be a way that you can use Handbrake to do the combination, although once again, I've never done that personally. So unfortunately, I can't walk you through the specific steps, but I'm hoping that maybe someone in the MacCast community probably can help us out. Also, you might be able to do it, and this may be how I actually combined the extended editions of The Lord of the Rings. You may be able to do it using iMovie or Final Cut 10, but I think if you use one of those tools, you are going to have to re-encode the video on export, which means, you know, some time, and it could be a lot of time depending on the size of the movie. You know, both these things are both, you know, Godfather Part 2 and, you know, the Lord of the Rings extended editions. These are long movies. I think in the case of Lord of the Rings, you're talking like four and a half hours of video that you're pushing together. So if you're trying to do that with iMovie or Final Cut 10, that's going to take a lot of processing power and a lot of time. So it'd be nice to get a tool that doesn't do any re-encoding, just sort of muxes the two files together, and away you go. And I'm sure there's got to be a WYSIWYG tool out there, though my Google Foo, which is usually pretty good, totally failed me. So this is where you come in. You, the members of the community, what are you using to do this? There has to be something. Let us know about it. Send me an email, maccast@gmail.com, and we'll share it out on a future episode of the MacCast. So stay tuned, Ryan. Hopefully we'll have a better solution for you. But if not, look into FFmpeg from the command line. Stephen wrote in to me, speaking of new HomePod features, Stephen wrote in to tell me that he discovered that his HomePod can actually play, in some cases, conventional radio stations. Did you know this was a thing on the HomePod? I certainly didn't. Now, these are not stations, in case you're saying, well, of course, Adam, you can play stations through AirPlay using TuneIn radio directly to your HomePod, or iHeartRadio, or maybe even from iTunes in the internet radio section. No, that's not what we're talking about here. We're not talking about using AirPlay. We're talking about actually asking your HomePod directly to play conventional, quote-unquote, conventional radio stations. Stephen is actually in the UK, and at the moment, he says he seems to be able to play stations from global. If you go to global.com/radio, you can see some of the stations that they have available. So you can say things like, hey, lady, play smooth radio, and it will work. And I have to tell you, I confirmed that even here in the U.S., I'm able to issue that command, and it will play smooth radio from global radio out of the U.K., and it will do it just fine. Now, I thought, okay, well, if it's able to play those radio stations, then maybe it's able to play some of the radio stations that are listed in the internet radio station section inside iTunes. Unfortunately, I personally couldn't get any of those to work. Occasionally, there'd be a podcast associated with that radio station, and that would work, but that was just coming out of the podcasts. And once again, that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about radio played over your HomePod, you know, traditional terrestrial-based radio, streaming radio stations. And so I played around with this a little bit more and discovered that I could get NPR to play. There's also, like, CBS radio, some of the radio stations that are supported by the news features on the HomePod, those seem to work. But in the case of NPR, it wasn't just national NPR. You could ask for specific regional NPR radio stations. Not all of them, but I could get like San Diego's KPBS radio to play directly on the HomePod. So that may be a hint. It seemed to be some of the radio selections that are available inside Apple Music. So if you look in iTunes and Apple Music, there is a radio tab, and of course it has all of the Beats One radio stations. It also has all of the genre-based radio stations that you can, or radio playlists, I guess is a better way to put it, that you can play in Apple Music. But also in there are listed, a couple of news radio stations, and you can play those directly for the HomePod. So I have a feeling that's where the hint is, but outside of that, I have no idea how you figure out what stations are available or supported, nor can I find any information on it. So once again, I'm going to turn to you in the community. Have you run across this feature? Are there more radio stations that we can play directly on our HomePods? What ones have you found? And is there a list somewhere? Has somebody compiled a list of these radio stations? But it was very cool for Stephen to write in and even mention this, because I had no idea that this feature existed with the HomePod at all. So it's looking like there's some radio support. How deep it is or how far it goes, that's what I'd like to figure out next. So if you can help us out with that, shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. And then finally today, let's talk about torture testing AirPods, and maybe not deliberately. There is one MacCast listener who seems to be on a mission to kill his AirPods if he possibly can. So let's check in with Bill and see what he's done to his AirPods this week.
Hi, Adam. Bill here from Ontario, Canada, little town Mississauga, outside of Toronto. I've been on the show before for my AirPods. Dropped them in the snow. Well, I had another accident when I was staining my deck. One fell out directly into practically a full can of deck stain. And my reaction was to reach in and pull it out, of course. Hand covered in deck stain, holding my AirPod. In the back of my mind thinking, they're gone, they're ruined, there's nothing I can do. But I ran into the garage, threw my hand into a grocery bag, then went into the house downstairs in my laundry room where I had brush cleaner and like paint thinner. Totally doused them in the paint thinner, cleaned my hand off. I could even feel my hand burning a little bit. And then rinsed them under water. Totally, like, dousing them under the water. And then I just left them to dry and went back bitterly to finish staining my deck. This happened a few weeks ago. It was, like, 40 degrees out, but I was crazily staining my deck. But when I came back in to check on them after they were dried, say, like, 8-10 hours later, they worked, that one that fell out worked flawlessly with the other one. I don't see any problems. I mean, something may come up in the future and I'll always second guess it, but this pair of AirPods have been through a week in minus 30 degrees temperature in a snowbank, and after that, months later, they fell in a bucket of deck stain. So definitely an excellent product. And thanks for the show. All that you do, and I listen all the time on my commute and at home. Thanks so much.
Bye. Hey, Bill, what have those AirPods ever done to you? Wow. I definitely would not advise doing any of the things that Bill has done to his AirPods, to your own AirPods, but still an amazing testimony to their apparent durability. I don't know about surviving a dip into paint thinner, Bill. But you know, if you say they're working great, then that is fabulous. That is really, really good news. I'm curious to know what you're going to do to them next. You know, I guess you haven't lit them on fire yet. Not that I want to really give you any ideas. Don't light them on fire, Bill. Please don't. But that's really cool. That is really cool. And thank you for sharing your story with us. With that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor. That is Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen for iOS, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at BackbeatMedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, or if you have any feedback for me, if you want to comment on something that I asked about in this episode of the MacCast, you can send me emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.